Why don't we begin? I believe the recordings have already started. It is Monday, January 26, 2015. This is a meeting of the RFP3 subgroup of the CWG for IANA stewardship for the naming functions. I'm Greg Shatton, and we can begin, although we have no agenda up in the notes. We'll begin with the usual welcome, which we've just completed, and we will turn to the usual roll call.
Hi, Greg. This is Marika. As per usual, we'll take the attendance from the Adobe Connect room, and if anyone that's only on the audio can maybe identify themselves, and we'll note them down for the record. Not hearing any responses. I presume everyone that's on the Adobe Connect room is also...
This is Shiva. I'm on the audio line.
Okay, we'll note your name. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, great. Thank you, Marika. That takes care of roll call. On our last calls, we ran through a number of both structural and functional, but primarily structural points on the CSC, which, while there are points of difference on the composition and powers and actions of the CSC, is possibly one of the more generally agreeable parts of the structure, various structures that we are looking at. Felt it was time to look at a structure that is not quite as beloved across the board, which is contract co. As I'm sure all of you know, there is also an RFP3B, which is looking at a what might be called an internal to ICANN solution, or at least at the at a contract co-list solution and what such a solution would look like. So that is kind of the activity of that group. Expected that these groups, given their the RFP3 and 3B nomenclature, indicates that the groups will attempt to converge at some point in the near future. But right now, RFP3B is kind of the skunk works for a an alternative solution, or the internal to ICANN solution of various types. So felt it was important in this group to look at contract co, at some of the things that have been developed before, try to develop some of the details behind contract co, see where there are areas of convergence or divergence, or bimodal divergence in each of the aspects of contract co. As might be expected, there weren't that many aspects of convergence for contract co in the polls, or rather surveys. There weren't polls that we took before. What I'd like to do is to dive in and discussion and see what agreement, disagreement, thoughts, movement we can achieve with regard to what contract co would look like. And again, this assumes that there is a contract co. That doesn't mean you can't challenge the aspects of contract co, quite the opposite. But given that eliminating contract co entirely is the business of 3B, the idea here is to develop through the usual rigors of multi-stakeholder work the best possible contract co that could be proposed in such a type of proposal. So I'll begin with the first issue. and proposed response, and would like to open discussion on each of them as we go along. First is the entity status of Contract Co. As indicated by its name, it would be, it's intended to be a corporation, and the view generally taken is that it would be a nonprofit corporation. So I'll take any comments on its corporate status, or more particularly on its nonprofit corporate status, and any thoughts on that. Martin Boyle.
Thanks very much, Greg. Sorry, Mark Boyle here. Just showing my ignorance about the nature of U.S.-based nonprofit corporations. Does that give any specific requirement for the resources of the nonprofit corporation, or can it actually be a $1 company?
When you say a $1 company, Martin, I'm not entirely clear how you're, and the resources, I'm not entirely clear whether you're asking it about how well it should be funded, or something different.
It's how well it should be funded.
The answer to that, and you know, obviously this is not legal advice, although I am a lawyer, but you know, speaking from my best understanding of the subject, is that a not-for-profit corporation, like a for-profit corporation, has no particular funding or minimum funding requirements. It may, if it's intended to carry on certain activities, or if it is to, it may be required by counterparties to have a certain amount of funding. But there's certainly no statutory requirement that it have any funding or funds whatsoever. And I realize we have people from a number of different countries, legal jurisdictions and experience and the like. And just one thing that needs to be pointed out, because it seems to come up repeatedly on the list and other discussions, nonprofit does not mean that it can't make money. Nonprofit merely refers to the fact that it doesn't have shareholders and therefore doesn't return profits to any third party. Everyone is familiar with the nonprofit known as ICANN, which, while it certainly may make a profit or keep a surplus of income over expenditures, it doesn't turn it over to shareholders. So a nonprofit can be as profitable as it wants to be, but it's distinguished by it not being run to return profits to shareholders. Typically, however, a nonprofit has to have a public interest purpose, a public benefit purpose of some sort, although it can also be for the purpose of its members if it's a membership corporation. Ridori.
Hello. Thank you. Yeah, I was unmuting. This is Aubrey speaking. In addition to the difference between profit and accumulating value, the other difference is that you actually, if I understand correctly, in the U.S., you don't found a nonprofit corporation. You first found a corporation, and then you apply for the nonprofit status. What I'm wondering is, and that is by no means guaranteed, so I'm wondering is, what are the time ranges in that sort of calculation? Because we would need to, perhaps that's not critical to hear, and maybe it's a question that belongs more in one of the RFPs that have to do with implementation. But how long does that take, and what is the likelihood that applying for it gets it for you? Thanks.
Thanks, Aubrey. Let me clarify on that. There are two steps to becoming what often referred to as a 501c3 organization, which actually refers to a type of tax-exempt status granted by the IRS. When a company first incorporates as a nonprofit, it is immediately characterized as a nonprofit. That status is part of its incorporation. And indeed, you'd have to apply, at least I'm more familiar with New York than California, but I believe it's basically the same. You need to apply in a different fashion to become a nonprofit. You actually need some level of approval at the very beginning, although it's fairly ministerial approval based on your bylaws and articles to be a nonprofit corporation by the state. Typically, that doesn't take very long, but it can take some time, depending upon the various things. So a nonprofit is once a nonprofit corporation is formed, it can then immediately apply to the IRS for tax exempt status, which also grants it the ability to accept charitable donations and subject it to various legal privileges and the like to get that apply to tax-exempt corporation. There's 501c3 is the most common. There are other ones that are based on other types of corporate missions, such as religious or trade associations or the like. We'll get the deeper. We can dive more deeply into this with legal experts that we'll retain for the purpose. But the basics are that there's two stops. Stop number one is get incorporated as a not-for-profit under the laws of a particular state of the United States. It could be New York, it could be Delaware, it could be California, Alaska. And then secondly, once you're incorporated, you seek and then are granted 501c3 status, which is a good thing to have, but unless you're actually accepting charitable donations, it's not entirely necessary. It is good to have for various reasons. That can take you 2 to 4 months. But you can begin functioning immediately as soon as your filing is in with the IRS, and then it relates back to the original date of filing when it's granted. So that may be getting into the weeds a little bit on the explanation, and just the average. I don't think the funds would be considered charitable donations, but they would be supplied to the extent that there are any funds, I think, through contract, more likely. In any case, Olivia.
Thanks very much, Greg. Olivia Kafanov speaking. Can you hear me?
Absolutely.
Oh, fantastic. Thank you. I have knowledge or experience with limited liability corporations. What's the difference between of course, apart from the obvious non-profit part, but what else is different between a limited liability corporation and non-profit corporation as far as liability is concerned? Is there a difference with that, or can one have a non-profit limited liability corporation?
Well, and again, we'll get real legal experts who can dig deeper than I can. But basically, all corporations provide limited liability, non-profit and profit. The limited liability corporation is always a for-profit corporation, and it was created as an alternative to the traditional corporation, and it's kind of a somewhat lighter weight structure for for-profits. It has members rather than shareholders, but the members, it's not a membership organization per se, and it has units rather than shares. And there are certain legal advantages, especially for startups and smaller companies, to be formed as an LLC rather than as a corporation. But since it's a for-profit entity, it's actually kind of off our radar screen. There are a couple of different. Each state has its own not-for-profit laws, and they vary subtly and sometimes not so subtly from state to state. Then there are sometimes more than one type of not-for-profit structure, but they are fairly similar from one to the other. So the LLC is off on a different, is off as part of the for-profit menu of prospective entity structure. So, anything further on? Yes.
Greg, it's Olivier for a follow-up, if I may. So, as far as liability is concerned, then, I'm just trying to sort of make sense of what that entices for employees or director or anyone related to that nonprofit corporation. Are there any higher higher standards of liability, or I'm not quite sure how to formulate my question. Sorry.
Yeah. Well, at the highest level, corporations provide a shield from liability for officers and directors and employees acting within the scope of their duties. If they go off out of the scope of their duties, then they may be subject to all sorts of liability. Having limited liability doesn't mean immunity from prosecution. In the U.S., as in most other countries, anybody can sue anybody for anything. If it's frivolous or in bad faith, they may be subjecting themselves to fines and sanctions and all sorts of other bad things. But putting aside bad faith, frivolous lawsuits, if there is a good faith basis for it, there's the possibility, at least, of being sued. Typically, companies carry D&O insurance, directors and officers insurance, which will protect their directors and officers and make sure that they're indemnified and defended for all actions within the course of their employment. And, of course, that's a massive oversimplification. There are people who spend, every day of their lives advising on nuances in this area, but that's the kind of 10,000-foot view in terms of liability and protection from liability. There are other nuances as well, but that's the kind of the basic overview. So that is the basic, look at non-profit corporation, at least under U.S. law at a very, simplistic level or simplified level. If there's nothing further on the that level, looking at the next, always a interesting subject for consideration. I've inserted here the contract co will be a Delaware corporation. And the reason that I suggest, or that some of us have discussed and suggested, having a Delaware corporation is that would put it in a state other than California and would provide the possibility, if it were in litigation with ICANN, which hopefully it never would be, but one of the reasons for having contract co is to be able to have the power to enter into litigation to force ICANN to abide by the IANA contract. And so if both corporations are in California, the federal court jurisdiction that is based on diversity of jurisdiction would not be available. We'd have to look to other types of jurisdiction. And since diversity jurisdiction is the easiest to satisfy, having the corporations be in two different states for purposes of incorporation would be a good thing. Delaware, more than any other state, is a friendly home for corporations. There are many particular services set up for corporations that do all of their actions outside of Delaware to have necessary kinds of services such as a service of process and corporate filings in Delaware. It's almost a kind of a Delaware cottage industry like Vermont turns out cheddar cheese and maple syrup. Bernie and others may argue about the quality of Vermont maple syrup versus Canadian maple syrup, but in any case, and Alan may as well, but that is what Delaware is set up to provide kind of a good corporate home. They have very sophisticated state agencies and judges that see corporate issues all the time and are not going to be likely to come to bizarre, unprecedented types of decisions should that ever be the case. But and their laws are set up to be also Delaware law is set up to be very easily adopted in terms of corporations by third parties, and there are a number of presumptions written into the jurisdiction as well that make it that allow for kind of standard corporate, whether it's profit or nonprofit, aspects of the running the corporation to be standardized without having a great deal of kind of custom drafting needed. So, Donna Austin, your hand is up. Donna, you may be on mute.
I am on mute. I had to. I'm using my phone instead of my laptop today, so I'm a bit confused. Thanks, Greg. Donna Austin. So, just one of the things that I would mention, and I don't know how relevant this is because I'm not a lawyer, but of course, all the registry agreements are signed under California law. So there may be some major reasons why the registries would like to maintain contract code to be in the US. I don't know for sure, but it just seems that there might be some benefits in doing so. So I thought I'd mention that. Thanks.
Thanks, Don. Any other comments on this point? I know this is one that people are often interested in commenting on. Not that I want to get hung up on it, but do want to make sure we give this its due. Just to make clear, this is, when we say jurisdiction here, we're talking about its domicile, where it would be considered to be. So it would be considered to be a corporation formed in the state of Delaware. If it's physically located anywhere, they would also have some issues with their state of a physical domicile. But that's Delaware is a very neutral corporation, and probably in my career of dealing with corporations, probably seen, even though I work in New York, I probably see as many Delaware or more Delaware corporations than I see New York corporations. And even New York is considered to be a relatively good state for incorporation. You almost never see corporations from, say, Nevada or Oklahoma, unless they're very local. So it's the home for national and multinational corporations. In any case, but so would litigation be in Delaware according to Delaware law? Those are kind of two separate parts of jurisdiction. Venue, which is the issue of where the litigation would physically take place, is typically specified in contract. It doesn't have to be the same place as the state of incorporation or the state that where the laws will be coming from. Often it's good to have them all be the same. We could specify California venue applying Delaware law, but I think it's probably a pretty fair idea to have it have litigation be in Delaware according to Delaware law. So any comments here? I see the comment says Delaware is famous for money laundry. I'm not familiar with that. It's famous for
having the only Swedish colony in the United States in colonial times. Maybe that was where the money laundry was. I'm presuming Mill is Milton Mueller. Any further comments on the issue of jurisdiction? Or we'll move on to membership. As postulated here, Contract Co. would not have members. I know that, especially for those of us who are participating in the accountability group, the discussion of membership has been quite spirited. The reason for membership, at least a membership for an active corporation like ICANN, is that the membership provides one of the few ways of taking a not-for-profit corporation and controlling the board to some extent, or having control over the board under limited circumstances. The members function somewhat like shareholders. Given the limited structure and purpose that we'll get to in a little while, postulating this would not be a membership company, membership corporation. Obviously, there are alternatives. It could have a membership. The members could be the MRT, or it could be drawn from representatives of the multi-stakeholder community. Typically, membership corporations are set up for their members, so they may be something like a religious order or a fraternal organization or a co-op of some sort. There are, of course, membership organizations that for other purposes as well. But again, given the idea that we're going to try to control this corporation through its bylaws, and don't think that a membership adds a different, an additional layer of complexity, and that complexity is one of the things we're trying to avoid, would suggest not having members for contract, though. Any comments on the membership side of things? Alan Green.
My only comment is we started off this whole premise saying Contract Co. would not become another multi-stakeholder organization, and having members starts getting perilously close to violating that rule. Thank you.
Thank you, Alan. I actually agree, which is why I think the prime postulate is that it's not a membership organization. It's intended to be as small and boring and understaffed and underweight as it needs to be, except when it needs to be essentially blown up to larger than life size in order to take on the Leviathan. But certainly adding members adds both complexity and adds a lot more personality to it than we would want, I think, to have. So moving on, seems to be a reasonable amount of agreement that membership is not the way to go. But I didn't want to be too presumptuous in setting this this document up for discussion. Relationship to ICANN, clearly the very essence of Contract Co. is that it's independent of ICANN. It's a third party with no structural relationship to ICANN. The intent, the prime and essentially only intent of Contract Co. is that it would enter into an IANA functions contract with an IANA functions operator, and given the satisfactory job ICANN is doing at the moment and has been doing for some time, that ICANN would be the first signatory to an IANA functions contract with Contract Co. That's basically, that would be the relationship that I think is kind of the essence of this. I don't expect too much discussion, but I'm not going to control discussion. So if there's anything on this point, I will My mother-in-law is saying that it sounds uncontroversial. I guess that is Milton. They listen to my mother or my mother-in-law. Therein hangs the problem. In any case, the relationship to the MRT is also kind of a fundamental aspect. The contract code will take direction from the MRT. As we'll see in the next row, the MRT, how the MRT relationship will take place. Olivier Capin-Labonde. You may be on mute.
Yeah, thank you very much, Greg. It's Olivier speaking, and yes, unmuting is a little harder than sometimes. You mentioned that it would need to be, I think you used the term beefed up when taking on the Leviathan. Are you saying basically if it was sued, for example, how do you envisage that, or is this something that we're touching on later on?
Well, I think we can touch on it lightly at this point. This is something that's contemplated actually in the contract, which is that ICANN would indemnify and hold harmless and provide the funding for any litigation in which Contract Co. was involved. That would be one of the necessary clauses of the new IANA Functions contract. That way it doesn't need to be independently funded or to have any kind of litigation war chest that is separate. And any new IANA Functions operator, in the some future world, would also have to be the indemnifying party. So ICANN wouldn't stay as the indemnifying party if it was no longer the IANA Functions operator. That would be a responsibility of the IANA Functions operator to indemnify, defend, and hold harmless contract in lawsuits, whether they be from third parties or from the IANA Functions operator itself.
Greg, Olivier, for follow-up. So that would, holding immune or indemnifying Contract Co. with ICANN would work if there was a contract between ICANN and Contract Co. But if the contract is reallocated to another IANA Functions operator, would this indemnification still work? I mean, would it still be viable, or would one say, well, hold and indemnify until another contract operator takes position? I'm a bit confused on that.
Yeah. The idea is that it would be, and I guess this is one of these points where we have to, and I should be careful when I'm talking about ICANN as such and ICANN as the IANA Functions operator of the moment. And so I should rather say that the IANA Functions operator will indemnify ICANN, will indemnify Contract Co., and whoever that IANA Functions operator will be. So if the contract ever gets granted to a third party, we'll call it OCL. If OCL becomes the new IANA Functions operator, it will become the new indemnifying part. Now, there are certain circumstances, and in many cases, the indemnification under an agreement, it will be enforceable after the term of that agreement. So a lawsuit that related to actions that took place during the contract with ICANN would be subject to indemnification by ICANN, even if the contract had terminated. And the litigation at the same time that related to activities taking place while OCL was the IANA Functions operator would be indemnified by OCL.
But it's Olivier, as a follow-up then to this, and sorry to be just pointing on this since we're having the discussion, and I think it's important to be a bit clear on this. What stops ICANN from having a third party sue? That seems to now start
start to widen the identification to wider than just ICANN itself, and give a lot of green lights for Contract Co. To do as it pleases.
Well, the indemnification protects Contract Co. from any third-party litigation and from ICANN. So the first thing that would prevent a third-party from suing the Contract Co. is it would need to have a valid cause of action against Contract Co. And if a third-party sued Contract Co., then under this scenario, ICANN would be bound to indemnify, defend, and hold Contract Co. harmless.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you, Olivier. Alan Greenberg has been patiently holding his hand up. His virtual arm must be tired.
It's very tired. I'd like to talk about the MRT. The concept that it's a committee of Contract Co., I think this is the first time I've heard that. I may have missed something in the past. That sounds problematic on several different levels. First of all, it goes back to Contract Co. having the essence of a multi-stakeholder organization, which, again, we were trying to stay away from. It implies that the board of a company can, of a nonprofit company, can take direction from a committee of that company, which has been disputed strongly by some members of this group that it couldn't work in ICANN. Maybe Delaware law is so different from California law that it would allow it, but it's been claimed it isn't allowed currently. We've never actually gotten a legal opinion on that, but it's been used continually. And this seems to be problematic on a whole bunch of levels. On top of that, MRT giving instructions to the board, it's not clear how the board could not change the MRT, one of its subservient committees. So this sounds like problematic on a whole bunch of levels.
Well, and I'll put my if I can respond to that a couple of different ways. First, the items that are in this structural analysis in brackets are kind of alternate themes or alternate takes and not the mainstream of what has been discussed over time, but they are some that have cropped up as variations. And so I put them in here not because they work or because they're better than what's not in brackets, but because they deserve some level of an airing. And so, you know, that's one point that explains what the bracketed language is here to do. Secondly, this is something we do need, obviously, to get a legal opinion on, but there are certainly ways in which board committees control and advise the board, and the board is more or less duty bound to take their advice, subject sometimes to very technical methodologies to do so. The NGPC is an example of a board committee that generally gets to instruct the board, but obviously it's not a mandate. It still can be voted on, and not always voted in favor of. Delaware law may provide some other aspects of that. There's some appeal to having it be a committee, but I actually tend to agree, Alan, that the having it as a committee kind of doesn't put it in the right place or relationship to the company. I'm not so with my coordinator hat, I'm not endorsing any part of this in the sense of trying to put together a good Contract Co. I, you know, particularly don't have any love for the idea of MRT being a committee of Contract Co., but it is out there as a possibility. Martin Boyle.
Thanks, Greg. Martin Boyle here. I'd like to go back to your exchange with Olivier, because that sort of led me to a certain number of alarms on indemnification. If you're seeking ICANN to indemnify Contract Co. and then presumably the MRT, bearing in mind the MRT is the organization that eventually will instruct the Contract Co., what you're saying is that if ICANN believes that the Contract Co. or MRT are working beyond their mandate, or because they are misbehaving in some way, then ICANN would have to fund its opponent costs, even if it won the case. It just seems to me that, you know, sort of what we're now saying is that, you know, there seems to be almost a sort of risk of freedom for the Contract Co. and or the MRT not to have any direct controls on them on misbehavior. And that seemed to me just to be a little little bit wrong. So I'd just like to explore a little bit more what terms of indemnification would seem to be reasonable. Thank you.
Well, there's quite a bit in there. I'll try to unbundle it a bit. First, the U.S. as a jurisdiction is almost always a jurisdiction where each party bears its own costs. So loser pays is generally speaking not a part of the U.S. legal system. Obviously indemnification can change who ultimately pays, but if you have two parties, one suing each other, they almost always will bear their own costs regardless of who wins. There are certain exceptional cases, especially under certain statutes, where there will be where the winners will will be upset. But that's the general case. I know that in the UK and a number of other jurisdictions, each party bearing their own costs regardless of the outcome is not the law of the land. That said, indemnification itself is a very common, almost universal aspect of contracts between parties. It's somewhat less common, but not all that uncommon at all, to have the indemnifying party indemnify against a third party. Indemnify a third party against third-party litigation, against second-party litigation, if you will, by the indemnifying party as well. As Milton points out, ICANN forces registry and registrar contractors to indemnify it. And typically, the indemnification is often something that's negotiated on the basis of leverage. So you can take what you will from that. As far as whether that's decreases contract host culpability or accountability, I don't think that it does. Obviously, you know, losing would still fundamentally be a problem, since, you know, typically losing doesn't involve just payment of cost. And even if it's damages are being paid by ICANN, specific performance and equitable relief, injunction, and the like, would still be borne by Contract Co. And also, if Contract Co. is in essence an arm of the multi-stakeholder process and the multi-stakeholder model that's embodied in the MRT, then that's a problem for the multi-stakeholder operation as a whole. So that's it seemed to me that, you know, we have
the fundamental aspect, is not that because you have indemnification, you can act with impunity. If that were the case, then we would have all sorts of corporations and individuals running around acting with impunity, because there are, indemnifications in hundreds of thousands of contracts, if not more, in the United States. Alan Greenberg.
Thank you. Back on the subject I raised a little while ago that we seem to have wandered off of the MRT being a committee of Contract Co., I tend to agree with you that having it as a committee opens a set of problems, but not having it as a committee or not having it as the board, as someone has suggested, opens up a whole new host of problems of exactly what is the relationship between the nebulous MRT and Contract Co. Contract Co. is going to be taking orders from it, but all we have is a three-letter initial or a full name and nothing specifying exactly who or what it is that we are taking these orders from. There's an interesting MRT.org, I believe, that's a repertory company, and we might want to take orders from it. Thank you.
Yeah, I think we'll do a little better job of defining the MRT. As a matter of fact, you think back to our earlier discussions of the MRT structural analysis last year. The MRT would have a charter. It would be an organization that would have a multi-stakeholder, although we haven't decided exactly what multi-stakeholder composition it would have. And the bylaws, which is the next box we get to, the bylaws of Contract Co. would specify that it takes its instruction from the multi-stakeholder review team. So I don't think it's all that poorly defined. And indeed, I think, keeping it, one of our original ideas in the design was to keep each of these entities somewhat free of each other, so that there would not be any what some people call empire building. So keeping MRT somewhat independent of ICANN while of Contract Co. is part of the design. But I think it would be well defined, at least as well defined as any chartered organization or activity would be. Milton.
Can people hear me?
Yes, we can hear you now.
Good. I don't have a very good signal strength where I am. So I was thinking about whether the MRT should just be the board of the Contract Co. and I agree with you sort of answered that question when you said you wanted to keep these entities separate so that there wouldn't be any empire building. Isn't it possible as part of the Articles of Incorporation and so on to keep the MRT within the same bounds as Contract Co.? And then I would like to hear more, if you don't think that's a good idea, I'd like to hear more about the nature of MRT as a committee, which is independent of Contract Co. but can give it orders. How would the MRT be able to constitute itself? Would it be constituting itself under the Contract Co. bylaws and articles or some other way?
Thanks, Milton, or mother-in-law. I think that it's not... we should not dismiss out of hand the idea of the MRT or a multi-stakeholder board acting instead of the MRT. But I think for purposes of discussing things in modules, to say that the MRT could be the board of Contract Co. and that, yes, the Articles of Incorporation and bylaws, would restrict the actions of the MRT as the board, and that would be, as effective, and we can talk about that, as any other, set of restrictions against, the overreaching of a board. I think that, however, in contrast to ICANN, where that is an issue, which is, getting a great deal of discussion and, for obvious reasons in the accountability group, that setting up a new corporation from scratch with a very limited mandate, and the idea that mandate will remain very limited, gives you a lot more ability to really restrict the actions of both the board and the executive staff, if there is one. And the idea is to have little or no staff, of course. But when setting up a company from scratch, there are a lot of models for limited purpose corporation that take place under a variety of scenarios that do little or that do very little or have a single role to play of one trick pony, which ICANN can never be. So it is, I think, worth considering. That adds some issues, it takes away others. We don't have this issue of the MRT hanging out in space, so to speak, not being affiliated with any organization in particular. So that's an advantage. A disadvantage is that it could potentially become more powerful. Also, makes it clear how MRT can instruct contract code because then it's the board. So, there are certain advantages, actually, to collapsing the MRT into the contract code board, which, certainly I think is, especially as we garner legal advice, we can get the pros and cons of how we can structure both the MRT as an independent body with the powers that we've talked about, and also as a board with both the powers and especially the restrictions that we know that it has to have, so that we don't end up with another independent thinking organization that seems perhaps to get away from the community or get in front of the community more often than perhaps it should. So I think that touches on the subject of that I think Milton has brought up. So if we don't have any, Alan Greenberg, your hand is up.
Thank you. I want to comment on something that's going on in the chat, claiming that if the MRT is in fact the board, we're not recreating another ICANN because it doesn't have a policy responsibility. If I remember the earlier discussions when we talked about, or it's been proposed, a concept like a board on top of ICANN, then that was deemed to be another multi-stakeholder body and therefore another ICANN. And up until now, when we've talked about recreating another organization with multi-stakeholders, the policy component was not the critical issue. It was another organization which remakes the controlling entities of ICANN. And I'm afraid putting the MRT as the board does that exactly. It's no longer an independent organization that has no mind of its own. The multi-stakeholders are now guiding that organization. And I think we've reverted right back to where we didn't want to be. Thank you.
Thanks for your comments, Alan. I guess I would think that to some extent it's a distinction with not a distinction without a difference, but a distinction with less of a difference. I think that one of the differences is generally is that there is no policy making function being written into contract code, and that it still would remain very limited in its nature, and even under the kind of the basic framework I'll call it the Frankfurt proposal. The MRT as a multi-stakeholder body was instructing Contract Co. So while Contract Co. had no mind of its own, it's mined by extension was a multi-stakeholder mind. So that's my thinking on that point. I think that it is not, we would not be kind of remaking all the same mistakes over again, but that's just my opinion. Anybody else on this point? And I still see there's lots of stuff in the chat. I'm trying to follow it as much as I can. I think some of the things we will get to in the next box or two. So, seeing no further discussion of this relationship to MRT point, I'll move on. And I think just to see something going on in the chat with regard to whether ICANN was originally set up to be a policy body. I think if you look at the original or the mission statement or that's in the, I believe, in the bylaws, it includes the IANA functions and it includes a policy function in there as well. But I'll just mention that by the by. Next up, speaking of organizational documentation, is the organizational documentation of contract code. So the idea, you know, given it's pretty standard for a, or the only standard really for a U.S. nonprofit corporation, is it would have articles of incorporation that bring it into existence. They're relatively short, and they you know, state some very fundamental basics about it. And then the bylaws, which provide kind of the internal law, as we know, of the way this corporation runs. So since we're getting a chance to set these up from scratch, we would set up both the articles and the bylaws to make it clear that this is a limited purpose corporation and that it was unable to act outside its very narrow mandate. The term limited purpose corporation is relatively well understood under U.S. law, you know, at this simplistic level at which, you know, we can discuss U.S. law. The idea is that there will be a clear and very limited mission statement and fundamental principles and limitations for contract code, so that it was basically chained up to the greatest extent possible and not able to, you know, creep its own mission, so to speak. And that the articles and bylaws would make it clear that the sole purposes of contract code were to hold the right to grant the IANA functions contract to some third party to serve as an IANA functions operator. And the general assumption we're all running on is that that first contract will go to ICANN, that it would serve as the legal entity actually granting the contract. It would be the party and to the contract, the counterparty. And that it would, to the extent that the legal party can't delegate these rights to MRT, and many rights can be delegated to the MRT, it would be the formal hand escalating the agreement and ultimately terminating the contract if there is the kind of significant, long-standing, uncured, uncurable type of non-performance that would cause one to rip this out of ICANN's hands, or possibly at the end of a term, cause you to grant it to a third party. The contract itself would embody all of the escalation and termination procedures and the like, and limitations. So this is not an unlimited thing, but to the extent that there's anything that's agreed between ICANN and the contract code, the articles and bylaws are not the place for it. Rather, the IANA functions contract would be the place for it. In an ideal world, I might have even tried to pull out of my back a draft set of bylaws for a limited purpose corporation, but I have not, and frankly, we might be better off getting that from our hired corporate counsel, who will, you know, we're going to hire to be, you know, very specifically expert in these types of topics, and this is not my area, the best I would do would be just to show you a model that demonstrates how it gets done, but not suggest that that's the way exactly we would do it. But there is, you know, a fair amount of precedent for bylaws for limited purpose corporations that are set up to avoid very kind of mission creep or self-starter sort of activities that we fear, both from Contract Co. and from any other organization that we tend to discuss. So any points on this point? Martin Boyle.
Thanks, Greg. Martin Boyle here. If it is letting a contract, then presumably part of its role is going to have to be to negotiate with those people who have responded to the request for proposals that's been devised by the MRT, and that may or may not include proposals from a contractor, a potential contractor, for the charges that it was going to levy. Where do those responsibilities lie? Do those go back to the MRT? So in other words, the MRT is the organization that actually decides on the eventual contractor.
Martin, I think under the model that we've been discussing, those duties would be are delegable, and they would be delegated to the MRT. Depending upon the structure and the legal advice you get, there may need to be some sort of final approval by the board of Contract Co. Or it may be purely mandated by the MRT. Regardless, the idea, if in fact the Contract Co. board has to make any decisions, the way and that they make those decisions and how they and what they weigh in making those decisions will be very specifically set out in the bylaws, and which is not the case in the ICANN bylaws. And really, frankly, for a sole purpose or multi-purpose corporation, very difficult to set out kind of very specific rules about how decisions are made. But for a corporation that has to make a fairly limited set of decisions, it can be done. But the actual, I think, the day-to-day work of running an RFP would fall to the MRT.
So if I can just do a quick follow-up to make sure I've understood that. When the Contract Co. Goes through the process of re-tendering, it's the MRT that would receive the tenders, choose the contractor, and then turn to the Contract Co. and say, you must contract with this organization. And that's actually the model that you're putting forward, is that?
Martin, that's correct, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Sort of the mother-in-law model. That kind of takes us through the concept of basic documentation that would be needed and how it would be set up. Seeing nothing further on this point, I'll move on to transparency. Clearly, one of the things that's important here is that we have full transparency, and would have contracts that would be transparent, open board meetings, open corporate records to the greatest extent, allowed by law. There may be some cases where you're dealing with confidential or sensitive information that you would just not be able to even get unless you agree to a certain amount of confidentiality, and only to the extent that that's absolutely necessary for the running of the corporation would those be held in any sort of confidence. But the idea is that this would be a highly transparent organization And at the same time, of course, the idea is that it would do as little as possible for as long as possible, and therefore, hopefully, that transparency would be mostly, you know, viewing a dormant company. So, if there are comments on that, seeing none, then move on to the accountability. The first, that the board and staff, if any, of Contract Co. would be accountable to the MRT. And this would be, you know, part of the relationship. And that we would also see the board members would be subject to appropriate recall mechanisms. And that the performance of Contract Co. would be subject to annual public comment and review by the MRT and the global multi-stakeholder community, and the budget, such as it is, would be subject to an equivalent review. Hopefully the budget will be as close to zero as humanly possible for such an organization. I think the idea, again, is to make the board, another comment on the board is that there are essentially services that provide disinterested board members. Who are essentially professional board members, whose only interest is in carrying out the role that they understand the corporation is to be, and are not interested in making the board or the company go in any particular direction other than what it's being told. So professional board members do get paid a small amount of money. Sometimes they get paid a large amount of money. Then again, non-professional board members also get paid. So, that's an issue kind of no matter how you slice it. Now, it could be that we have a volunteer board. So that's, you know, by no means, this is kind of getting down to a second or even third level of detail about how do you get board members who aren't going to get, silly ideas into their head. One way of achieving it, on top of all of the other controls in the Articles of Incorporation bylaws, accountability, recall mechanisms, and the like, is to get professional board members. But that's by no means common in the U.S., nor is it at all necessary for this type of model. It's somewhat more common in offshore jurisdictions. Jersey, Guernsey, Cayman, places like that have companies that make their business out of providing board members. So while it's a possibility, I would frankly recommend against it, partially for the reasons that Aubrey and Olivier brought up, that having board members who are being compensated for being board members are kind of adds a layer of cost to things. But again, I think that's one of the areas where some good legal advice could tell us whether, if the costs are modest, if it costs a few thousand dollars a year to get a completely disinterested, uninterested person to serve as a board member under very narrow circumstances, it may be worth it. On the other hand, as we're trying to be as uncomplex as possible, it's the kind of thing I would tend to stick away from or stay away from, unless we were advised that for some reason it's a vastly better idea than having a volunteer board. And given that there's certainly a number of volunteers around, then we could certainly deal with that that way. So, as Martin says, I prefer them to be paid in independent rather than pro bono or with vested interest. Now, that is kind of the balance. It may be, given what we expect Contract Co. to do, which is not to meet very often and not to have many responsibilities, that the cost of the board members could be quite small, and I would expect that to be part of the borne by the IANA functions operator in some fashion, through the contract or otherwise. That's not a case where you'd have board members being paid hundreds of thousands of dollars a year. I think it would be a small and uninteresting amount of money. Money is always inherently interesting, of course. That would not go into a long discussion of capitalism, the existence of money, loss of barter economy, etc. I think that is kind of the idea, is to try to find a way that the board is as that its only motivation is to carry out the very limited scope of the company and to take the appropriate directions of the MRT. So there are a variety of options there. I see Donna, I think it was Donna, suggesting the NomCom to bring it in. NomCom is always looking for things. And there are people who may have an interest in being seen as somewhat more credible in the field of Internet management or governance that might want to serve there. But then again, the whole idea is that they shouldn't have a say. They're not there to run the company in an independent fashion. They are there to serve the corporation, and this is not uncommon in a limited purpose corporation. That does, I think, actually get to the next point. If we had directors, regardless, we would look for directors to be as disinterested as possible and to understand as a mandate, as part of taking the job on, what their very limited role is. And while they may need to assess the instructions from MRT, the idea is that the bylaws would provide very explicit guidance on how to assess those instructions. So that anything other than a rogue MRT should be able to have Contract Co. accomplish what it needs to accomplish. Notice here also is that the staff of Contract Co. would be as small as possible. Hopefully, services could be arranged for, and it probably needs very little in the way of services, since its duties are by and large being delegated to the MRT. Next question here, if there's anything further on board composition. I see there's some stuff in the chat, but if there's anything particular that anybody would like to bring into the oral section, now is a good time to do so. Martin Boyle.
Thanks, Greg. Martin Boyle here. I just heard you say that, you've said several times now about the duties from Contract Co. being delegated to the MRT, but we're anticipating the MRT to be a group of volunteers, and an awful lot of the roles that we're asking the MRT to carry out could, in worst instance, be quite onerous. But am I actually hearing you right, that you are expecting a lot of these activities to be done by the MRT, and that is not only the decision-making body, but also the body that will draw up the documentation, the contracts, and stuff like that? Because that does trouble me a little bit, certainly on things like drawing up the contracts, policing the contracts. That was something I had assumed would be part of the role of the company that was holding the contract. Thanks.
Thank you, Martin. I guess we'll back up one step. I think that putting aside the RFP for the moment, there's not expected to be a lot of activity that Contract Co. Would do. And as far as policing the contract, that really is part of the role of the CSC and the MRT at different levels as we've set them up. So that Contract Co. would not have a kind of a third body which is actively looking for breaches of the agreement or for ways to invent or insinuate a breach that the recording and reporting responsibilities of the IANA functions operator would be going primarily to the CSC and on some of the longer arc annual or multi-year reports. I think we've seen those going to the MRT. So those, in fact, are already, I think, in our model delegated. The RFP is probably the most, onerous task that would be involved. And it's entirely possible. Well, first of all, I think we see the MRT, or as the MRT has been proposed, that it would have a secretariat. But the RFP being kind of a relatively rare occurrence, it's not, you would not want to have a permanent level of staffing necessary to issue an RFP. This is something that could, to some extent, be contracted for to a party that runs such things, or the MRT at that point could, you know, garner more support from the multi-stakeholder community in order to run the RFP. But I think that is kind of a basic issue that, obviously is here. That, you know, if you're going to run an RFP, it's not a small process. It's not a short document to draw up an RFP. I think, however, we have a lot of knowledge of what the and IANA functions operator should do, so the RFP is not going to be drawn up from scratch. And then you have to read a lot of long submissions that come back and make some judgments. So I think that ultimately does fall to the MRT, and there would need to be some form of funding for that, or and possibly the acquisition of additional skilled individuals, or contracting out for certain resources. That was, I think that was Lou Reed's Metal Machine music. In any case, so that's kind of how I've looked at it here. And in terms of enforcing the contract, as I see Martin said, I think, again, that goes under the indemnification provision. But I think that even there, the enforcement really comes from the MRT, and the contract code is sort of a sock puppet for the MRT. That may be a bad analogy, and so don't draw any bad conclusions from it. But that's basically the idea, is that contract code is the necessary tool that is used by the MRT to accomplish its functions, and not a separate power structure. Anything else on this point? Seeing none, I'll move on. I'll skip the question about members. That's not board members. That was intended to be members. So I think that can be skipped. Next question is, how would the board meet? Primarily phone, internet, not intended to, this is not a junket for however and hopefully few people as would be on the board. That terms lengths would be limited. They would be staggered as before. As in the other cases, to avoid knowledge gapping. How will decisions be made? And decisions will be made by the MRT and adopted by the board of Contract Co. And here, where obviously we need legal advice, if some sort of unquestioning adoption is not possible, the board could be required to vote unanimously against the MRT's instruction. And this is an idea, I think, that's being looked at by the accountability group, too, is to have change certain voting levels to allow for, if not absolute control, effective control, because, you know, given the limited mandate of the board here, the idea that this board that has been picked to put forth the model would unanimously vote against something that would seem to be consistent with the model would seem to be highly unlikely, to say the least. Alan Greenberg.
I guess I would say highly unlikely unless someone is trying to take control of the board and offers them. Remember, if we're not paying them, there's a financial incentive for them to perhaps take direction from somewhere else on an individual basis, one by one. So that sounds like it's counter to all the stability we want to bring into this.
Well, and I think, you know, the point of view of capture is, or the point, I should say, of capture is always, you know, lurking in the back of any of these structures, whether they're internal or external, or no matter how you structure them. That may be the reason to have a nominal or small amount of compensation, you know, consistent with the number of hours a person of reasonable level of sophistication would spend in a job such as this, or whatever that number may be, then, you know, as opposed to having it be on a purely volunteer basis. But, again, I think that you would have to have kind of unanimous capture, which, you know, gets to, I think, fairly extreme scenarios. So, it's something we do need to look at, and that's, I think, why there need to be recall and accountability by the board to the community. Anything further on this point? Support needs, next item up. The intention is that Contract Co. would have and would require little or no staff and delegate its day-to-day functions either to the CSC or the MRT or the Secretariat, depending on its, or the MRT Secretariat, which may be the same as the CSC Secretariat, for all of its day-to-day functionality. Probably have to have some form of a website, but not even necessarily. This is a supposed to be as dull an organization as possible, so a may not even need a website, although there would be a certain irony in its not having a website. And if it didn't, probably somebody would put a fake one up. And obviously would need to have an email list functionality of some sort, so that's at least a reason for it to have a domain name. Again, the irony of it not having a domain name would be one to avoid, as much as I like certain ironies. But the idea is to have as little structure as possible, and if there is some structure, you know, as things are, you know, delegated to the MRT, they would also have, the support would largely be off at the MRT as well. Alan Greenberg notes that if it had a website and a domain name, it could join the NCSG. Well, maybe it'll file for a trademark and then it can join the IPC. We'll have a fight over Contract Co. Hopefully it would be a member of nothing, because it would be such a nothing company. But in any case, back to work. When would the board meet? The board would meet as rarely as possible, consistent with legal requirements. Obviously, they would meet more often if there is an RFP situation going on, or if there is, you know, enforcement rising to the level of termination where things need to be voted on. But the idea is that it does as little as possible and as rarely as possible. Funding, this is somewhat of a punt, same as the MRT. And last, the Alan Greenberg honorary row capture. Safeguards must be in place to ensure that the board and staff cannot be captured or unduly influenced by governments, intergovernmental organizations, or specific economic or ideological interests. what those safeguards are, other than very narrow purpose and good vetting of individuals and transparency, which I think are all, you know, part of avoiding capture. We would need to explore. Certainly, we don't want anybody hijacking ContractCo. According to the Washington Post, apparently civil society is the way that foreign governments with ill intent will cause ICANN and perhaps ContractCo to be captured. That was only in an editorial. I think they must have been smoking something. Matthew Shears. Outrageous editorial. I think they're trying to one-up Gordon Krovitz of the Wall Street Journal in absurd editorials. And I think they achieved their goal. Any comments on capture or thoughts on how to avoid capture in this or any other situation? Seeing none, I'll say, are there any other thoughts on ContractCo generally? And also, while there isn't a, we haven't put in front of the group here a document that's a functional analysis of ContractCo. I think we've touched on its functions a number of times. But if there are any other comments on the functions of ContractCo, given the, I'll say, divisive nature of ContractCo, would be curious to hear any thoughts in general in favor or opposed to it, or how it could be better if you're one that doesn't think it's good enough the way it is. But as we're all looking at proposals that we don't love, to try to see if there are ways that we could love them more. I think that's the essence of convergence and ultimately of consensus. Is to keep an open mind and try to come up with the best proposal that we can amongst all of us. Milton.
Yes. I'm responding a bit slowly, and so I'm actually talking about the capture issue.
Yes.
Okay, good. So you can hear me. Yeah, I think one of the things we have to watch out for when talking about capture is that I think we all agree that registries, both CCs and Gs, have a, as customers of IANA, have a particular and very vital interest in the IANA. And so I wouldn't want to define capture by a specific economic interest in a way that precludes the actual registries, who are the customers of IANA, or the customer, including the root server operators, from being defined as a special interest group that's capturing a function that they depend on. I recognize that we want the MRT to be multi-stakeholder, but I also don't want any kind of definition of, dominance by a particular interest group to make it impossible for registries to be able to safeguard their direct interest in proper performance of the IANA functions.
Thanks, Milton. I think that's a good point. I think that given the nature of the IANA functions themselves, and putting aside issues of decisions that are made about the IANA functions, but that don't take place within the IANA function, but that take place, kind of elsewhere within ICANN as policy, which I think we, generally see as being outside of this whole structure. I would tend to agree with you. I do have concerns, as I've watched and participated in ICANN over the years, that, any particular group can try to exercise an outsized influence or an overarching influence over the activities in which it has an interest. I think there are some who might even say that the registries have exercised a great deal of of influence over, say, for instance, the applicant guidebook, but I think that one of the reasons, one of the ways that you combat that sort of inference is to point at the multi-stakeholder model and to point at how the pushing and pulling of working groups and others have you know, kept any group from complete excess, at least, you know, idealistically speaking. But I think that it, especially if we define the ANA functions right, and if we define the roles of these organizations right, then there should hopefully be very little interest and very little latitude for interesting things to happen through the oversight of the IANA function operator. As Paul Kane, I think, said, you know, in Frankfurt, this is all supposed to be very boring. And by keeping roles and responsibilities narrow, I think that, you know, the registries, you know, that have an interest in the best possible functioning IANA that functions smoothly, that where the trains run on time, you know, should be in the interest of all stakeholders. You know, getting to the point of defining capture versus not capture by any particular organization, I think the definition of capture, you know, needs to be, I think, flexible and not merely a counting of noses type of thing. Milton, is that a new hand? I hope it is, because I'm kind of holding forth here, and I prefer not to do that. Milton says it's okay. So I'm glad to hear that. Anything further on Contract Co? Clearly, you know, Contract Co being somewhat less easily understood than the MRT or the CSC, which resemble in rough form working groups that we're all familiar with, is the one where we need legal advice to make sure that it is workable and appropriate, and perhaps to calm the concerns of those who are concerned, or perhaps to underline and to confirm the concerns of those who are concerned. You know, there's only so far we can go in any of this without legal advice. I will assure you that we are working and redoubling our efforts to move toward getting legal advice. And this is a subject of action on my part just about every day for the last little while. And hopefully, you know, we'll see more happening public in the very relatively near future. On that point, I would ask that if anybody has any thoughts on particular counsel that would be appropriate, first-rank counsel on this sort of thing with the type of areas of expertise that we're looking for. We are all ears for such referrals. And it's, you know, recognized as a major dependency for our group, regardless of the framework, whether it's internal corporate governance for an internal to ICANN or external corporate structuring for an external to ICANN, and a little bit of both for either, as well as not-for-profit and trust law advice. There's really only so far that we can go without expert legal advice, and we are hopeful that that will come to us in the very near future. So anything else on this point? I'm loath to switch to any other subject that we have, because we don't have very much time. But if there is anything, you know, anybody wants to bring up, not that I'm, you know, creating an open mic, this is not a mini public forum here, but you know, based on what we've discussed so far, if there's any thread that has been kind of thrown out there that anybody wants to pick back up, this would be the time to do so. And if Milton, if that's still a hand, obviously, you can speak. The hand has disappeared. So given that it is now 20 of, and given that for those of us who are on the Eastern Seaboard, if we're not in our homes, we should get to them because we're all about to get snowed in, many of us will, clearly not those in Florida, but there is a 2 to 3 foot snowstorm coming in for most of us. I'm not going to attempt the metric conversion, but it's bad, historically bad. So I will let us all get a little extra time to move on. We have enough hours of DWG business scheduled this week, as Ms. Grace's email pointed out, that we can take 20 minutes. Thank you, Aubrey, for the 30 to 60 centimeter conversion there. I think I might even get to a meter in some places, and plus there's going to be 50-mile-an-hour winds, and so it's a blizzard. So in any case, I will say goodbye to you all, and I will ask that we stop the recording.
Thanks, Greg. Thanks, everyone. Bye.
Well, goodbye, all. Stay safe if you are in the path of the storm. And I'm sure that I will hear you all very soon and see many of you in Singapore. Goodbye.
Thanks. Bye.